Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Snacky Tunes. I'm one half of your hosts, Darren Bresnitz, with Chef Noah Sandoval of Oriel Chicago, sitting in a beautiful freight elevator. I made the mistake of walking up the stairs because I thought the restaurant was all the way up.
Oh, sure.
Instead of just walking all the way back.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, if it's not open, you can't really tell.
No. So, congratulations. I think is how I want to start, because you know, your restaurant has just done some incredible things since the time it's opened. How does it feel to be part of the Chicago and the national food scene, like, right out of the gate?
It feels great. It's intimidating. It always has been, you know. I've been here for about 10 years and worked a lot of really nice places for a lot of really talented chefs. And you know, just to be able to kind of join that group, you know, of people that are teaching and pushing things forward. You know, there's so many awesome people in the city. It feels great, you know.
It feels good to be a mentor, to give back for someone who had a mentor himself, right?
Yeah, that's a crazy word to use for me, but yeah, but yes, sure.
Well, let's go back to a little bit to the beginning. You grew up in Richmond, Virginia, right?
That's right.
But you traveled around a lot as a kid?
Yeah, military family. Yeah, my dad was a SEAL, so.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, like the real?
Yeah, we traveled a bunch, and he was always, like, teaching schools in other countries and just, you know, doing stuff we couldn't know about. So it was pretty intense.
I'd love to share with you kids, but I cannot. And so what was it like traveling around? Anything from those early days influenced your later days?
I spent most of my time homeschooled, and I spent a lot of time with my mom and a lot of time cooking with my mom. And she was a great cook, and yeah, when I was bored, I would cook, or I'd play baseball by myself, which is kind of impossible.
Just string that ball up and just keep hitting.
We lived kind of in this. There was this big thing out front of the hotel we lived in for 3 years in Scotland, and I just threw the ball up and hit it.
Yeah,
and kept running.
And eventually, after traveling around the world with your dad, you wound up back in Richmond, and you started. You got a cooking job pretty much right away, right?
Well, I washed dishes for a couple of years to start.
What made you get right into a kitchen when you got back to Richmond?
Well, all of my friends were doing it. You know, I had a lot of friends that had just moved out of their parents' house or whatever, and they figured out that you could pretty much get a job at a restaurant without having any experience because you always need something to do.
Sure.
And luckily, I got into fine dining restaurants right off the bat. I've never worked in a restaurant that wasn't fine dining. But it was kind of just like a natural way to go for me. A lot of musicians, a lot of just, you can do whatever you want, you can wear whatever you want, you know, you can say whatever you want. Nobody sees you. All you gotta do is make sure things are clean.
As long as the dishes are clean, you can sort of do whatever you want.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you have been working in fine dining since the beginning. You actually worked under Chef David Shannon, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
What was it like working at Helen's, and what was it like sort of getting in and getting a mentor so early on in your career?
I think it's, I definitely would not be where I am now without him, giving me a shot at, you know, getting out of the dish pit and putting salads on a plate, and also understanding how to treat people, and you pay people as much as you can, and that you can be a total lunatic. He's a total lunatic. I mean, but in the best way possible.
Right.
He opened my eyes to a lot of things, you know.
I mean, it's sort of rare today for anyone to have a real proper mentor or to stay somewhere. I mean, it happens, but I feel like it's more, the route is jumping from restaurant to restaurant until you can sort of like jump your way up instead of staying somewhere and learning under someone.
That's killing me. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's killing everyone, but what can you say that, you know, outside of learning how to cook and the discipline, was the one thing you learned from staying somewhere from so young and having a mentor that you find indispensable today?
There is, you know, working at a restaurant you're not going to culinary school. You don't go there. I'm not paying you to learn and then leave. You know, mm-hmm. I'm paying you to do a job. If you learn something, great, and that's the most important thing, really. But what can you really learn in a year? A couple techniques. You can learn recipes. You can learn, I don't know. You can learn 100 things, but the most important thing is to learn how to handle yourself and how to, and longevity. You know, if you can work for somebody for 10 years, and they must be doing something right, so you see what they're doing, and you continue doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you always have one foot out the door, you're like, I don't have to learn that. I'm leaving anyway.
Exactly.
So you worked for David Shannon for a while, and you guys went to the Dogwood Grill and Spirits together, correct?
That's right.
What was that like, and what was it like to get brought along somewhere?
It was great. I mean, working at Dogwood was really amazing because not only David was there, it was another one of the other partners named Roger Lord, who taught me a ton about wine while I was working there. His hospitality was insane. Perfect. You know, those two together made something very beautiful, and I was really lucky to be part of it. And David's very loyal. He's probably one of the most loyal chefs I know, or loyal people in general. If he likes you, he'll take care of you forever. You know,
and which is amazing.
Yeah, it's totally amazing, and he's very selfless.
You know? And has it shaped the way that you take care of your chefs?
I try to, but he's got a very special knack for that. I try to take care of people as much as I can. I mean, my CDC has been with me for years now, I don't think that he's going anywhere, because hopefully I can give him what he needs, you know.
It's that balance of like staying true to the restaurant and making it something that's consistent, but then also allowing people to grow.
Exactly. Yeah. And then when it's time for people to leave, everybody knows it.
Right.
You know, if it's time for somebody to open their own place, everybody knows it, you know.
And then you hope you can do it and support them. That's how you grow.
Exactly.
Yourself as well.
Yeah. And hopefully there's some people, other people that, you know, feel that same way.
So you've been cooking for a while. How old were you at this point when you were at Dogwood?
What year was that? I think I was probably 23.
So you'd sort of been in kitchens for, what, 6-7 years at that point?
Yeah, I probably started when I was 16, yeah.
What made you start thinking about going to culinary school? Because arguably, you didn't have to. Like, you could have stayed in Richmond and worked and probably gotten your own restaurant without ever going to one class.
Absolutely. I really just used it as an excuse to move to New Orleans.
Oh, well, I mean...
That was it.
That doesn't take months.
Yeah.
So what drew you to New Orleans? I mean, more than anyone else, what drew you specifically?
On my 21st birthday, I spent it in New Orleans, and I'd never been anywhere like that. You know, I've lived in a lot of different places with my family, but never something so perfect for who I was at the time. You know, all I wanted to do was drink and cook and be outside and ride my bike, and, you know, there's a million things I wanted to do, and it had all of it. So, and it also had a culinary school, so I was like, okay, let's try this out.
After being, you know, a lot of times it's reverse. Most people who are in the restaurant world for 6 or 7 years don't go to culinary school. What did you find is the benefits, or were there none?
There were none. I got a job about three weeks before the school started, and I had been working for 3 weeks in a restaurant called Marisol.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing restaurant.
Legendary.
Amazing chef. Still friends. And the first day of school, they were like, here's a zucchini. Here's how you cut. This is how you hold your knife. I was like, yeah, fuck this. I'm not going to pay for this when I'm getting paid to learn twice as much in an hour. You know, I just couldn't handle it.
So dropped out?
Oh, yeah. I was there for like 2 months.
Really? Yeah. Did you get your money back?
I think I just didn't pay them. You know, it's just one of those like loan things. I was just... The credit was terrible for a long time.
That's fine. Yeah. And so how long were you in New Orleans for cooking?
About a year and a half, I think.
And then Richmond was calling back to you?
In a roundabout way, yes.
What's the roundabout way?
I can't tell you about that.
Okay. Well, we'll do that off the record. But so then you go back to Richmond and you get a sous job at Dogwood.
That's right.
Yep. And then what made you... How were you feeling at this point? Because instead of, you know, you were Richmond, New Orleans, then back to Richmond. Did you feel that like you could go beyond that? Like, did you feel that some other city was calling your name, or?
I didn't. That was when I first started to kind of vacation to Chicago.
Okay.
And I was on top of the world then. You know, I was working for my favorite person, you know, 5 days a week. Everything was super fair. We were pushing forward. We were getting a lot of accolades. And all the people I worked with are amazing. I still hang out with them when I go back to Virginia. That was like the highlight of probably my career at that point.
Uh-huh.
And Dogwood closed, and I opened another restaurant with a friend. It just didn't work out. We kind of butted heads, and
sure.
It just didn't. And I was like, "Yeah, okay, it's time for me to move on." And that's when I decided to come to Chicago.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick musical break. We're going to talk about some of the luminaries you worked for in Chicago, and then we're going to talk about the opening of Oriole and everything that's come with it.
Great.
We have a song from the archives on Snacky Tunes here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
We fall down. me, come and leg me, we're far down. Ooh, ooh, ooh. We fall down. Come and leg me, come and leg me, we're far down, down, yeah. And you're following the way, following the way.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are here with Chef Noah Sandoval in the Freight Elevator. I'm just out there. Hello, welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are with Chef Noah Sandoval in the Freight Elevator at Oriole. So what drew you to Chicago?
Oh, music. I like the music scene a lot here. Blackbird and restaurant for sure. Every time I used to come to visit, I would eat there, and they're always doing special things. It's a big city, and I couldn't afford to live in New York.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you got here, how did you get your first job in what was a line of incredible jobs under some of the city's top chefs?
So when I first moved here, I didn't know what a stage was. There was no staging in Richmond. Well, there probably is now, but there wasn't then.
What year was this?
2007.
Okay.
So I showed up for my job interview, dressed real nice, no knives, nothing.
Right.
Mike Simmons, who now owns Cafe Marie Jean in Humboldt Park, was the executive sous at this place called Sea House. And I showed up and I was like, all right, I'm here for my interview. He's like, well, do you bring any knives or anything? I was like, no, what do you mean? So then I left, came back for a stage the next day, got the job. Marcus Samuelson was the chef there. Mm-hmm. He wasn't really there, but he was the chef.
With the name. The name
yeah.
on the...
Yeah, he was the name on the menu. Yeah.
On the name of the chef. And so what was it like going from Richmond to New Orleans to a much larger city? What was the... Was there a shift in the demanding, or was it, since you had been trained so well, you fit right in?
I didn't know what I was doing at all.
You're like, I got this. Did you think you knew what you were doing?
I had a good idea of how to... kind of cook stuff, you
sure.
know, but it's a whole different world. I mean, it's not that it's better, but it's absolutely harder to as opposed to, you know, grilling meats in Richmond and grilling meats on a grill in New Orleans. Moving here and somebody tells you to, you know, circulate these steaks, and I didn't even put them in a bag. I just dropped them in the water. Like,
ooh.
And I was like, and the pastry chef saw me and she was like, dude, you're fucking up. You gotta get it out of there right now. And
least someone told you were fucking up.
Yeah.
Instead of just yeah. like throwing it
she,
at a wall.
She told me I was fucking up a lot, but
in a good way.
No.
Oh.
It was great. She's one of the best. But.
So then after Sea House, how long were you there for?
Not very long. I think I was there for eight or nine months.
Now, were you trying to find a place that you could land and be at for a few years, or were you just trying to like make the rounds to see what you like best?
At first, I was just trying to pay the rent, and
sure.
luckily, paid the rent. I didn't really like the environment, and they weren't very busy, and people's hours were getting cut, and then it got to the point where I needed to find another job.
Sure.
So I had to leave. But then I landed at a spring restaurant, Michelle McLean, and that was really, really good. I learned a ton there.
What did you learn? What did you add to your skills or your mindset?
At spring?
Yeah.
Oh,
how to properly cook fish, how to work at an extremely busy restaurant and still put out perfect food, you know, how to manage people. I learned how to season food quickly. I learned a ton of things, how to store fish, how to, you know, how to come in early if you needed to and stay late if you needed to, you know.
Interesting. So just more discipline, more responsibility.
Absolutely.
And then after spring, you moved to what is arguably one of the most infamous, legendary restaurants of Chicago, Schwa, which my brother and I had an insane meal at during one Pitchfork. We left the festival, had like a two-hour meal, got just murdered, and then went back and saw LCD Sound System.
Yeah.
And then tried to pay... And they kept putting the money back in our pockets.
Yeah, if they don't want you to pay, you're not paying. I mean, they'll send it to you in the mail if you try to leave a tip.
It was like, I was like leaving under plates, and they would just come up and like, no. And I was like leaving under nap, and they're like, no.
Yeah, if they don't want you to pay, you're not paying.
But I mean, so, you know, for those who don't know Schwa, what was the restaurant? And explain how different it was than probably the other places you had worked.
26 seats. You can't really tell it's a restaurant unless you knew that it was a restaurant called Schwa there. In a storefront. One menu, 13 to 15 to 20 courses, however many felt like doing. Very casual, but very, very refined and very whimsical and playful food. Not in a stupid way, you know, in a really cool way. Really thoughtful, highly intelligent. And it always has been and always will be. Working there was a bit tricky. You know, sometimes you were running to the store to buy more, you know, whippets for Michael.
Sure.
You know, or you were, there's a million things that I had to do when I worked there, and, you know, 10 of them were cooking, you know.
Sure. Some of it was personality maintenance.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I never did a single drug working there, you know. I was like kind of the guy who just drank and kind of tried to make everything
designated like cooker,
which I realize now is probably the wrong way to go about it. you know, it's.
But what did you learn there? Because they have a lot of unique and molecular sort of techniques, but it's not just to do them for doing them's sake. They actually are applying them in probably the best way possible.
I mean, you put it well by saying that. You know, it's. Everything, there's no like garnishes that aren't there for a reason.
Sure.
And think about every garnish, you know. He taught me how to bring certain elements into a dish by using things that look pretty or things that are manipulated in a way that doesn't just add visual, you know, appeal or everything, you know, texture, sweet or salty, something, everything brings something. That I always tell everybody that it's balance. You know, he taught me about balance. And there was an idea of seasoning food that I had before and an idea of balance that I had, but nothing like he does. I mean, he brings sweet so high and salt so high and acid so high that it all just makes sense and tastes like something completely different. You know, it's like celery doesn't ever really taste that good, but if you give it to Michael, it tastes better than anything.
Yeah, you're like, more celery.
Yeah.
Chef.
Yeah.
So how long are you there before you start thinking, I want a place of my own that you've done? I mean, you more than most chefs have really put in the time in a lot of restaurants in different cities, different states. When did you start thinking it was time for you to strike out on your own? And when did you start formulating what that could look like?
It was kind of a pretty interesting situation for me because I had gotten married a couple of years before.
Congratulations.
Thank you. She worked in a bank. And we never saw each other, especially at Schwa. I never saw each other. Maybe, you know, on Sunday, but I was tired and she was getting ready for work
right.
On Monday. And so I decided that I should maybe start to work during the day. You know, just kind of concentrate on the marriage, concentrate on the girl, because that's the most important thing.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I'm going to get a chef job at like a cafe or something. I'm just going to take it easy for a little bit. Because, I mean, Schwa takes a lot out of you. It'll make you... reconsider if you're
in it,
if you're doing anything right or wrong or anything. And that's when Senza happened.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that's a whole other podcast.
That's a whole other podcast. When Senza happened.
Senza happened was funny. I answered a Craigslist ad for a chef for the cafe, you know, complete control of the menu, things like that.
Yeah.
Did a tasting for it. It was really funny tasting because there was another chef in the same kitchen applying for the same job. So it was kind of like this weird Top Chef kind of cook-off. I'm not good at that. But I got the job and they said, no, great. You know, you're going to be a big part of this. You know, we can do whatever you want, but it's got to be gluten-free. And I was like, okay. And that's just like, those are dirty words.
Dirty words.
Dirty words for a chef. You know, like people come in on the fly and say they're gluten-free 10 years ago. 15 years ago, I was like, oh, I don't know what to do.
I don't know what to do.
I don't even know what that is. I don't even know what gluten is. But
now?
Yeah, I kind of took it head on and decided that, fuck it, I'm gonna see if I can do it. You know?
Yeah.
It can't be that hard. It was a little challenging in the beginning, but we came up with good recipes and had really good, talented people working, and everybody was in it to win it. And then things progressed, and we went from being open during the day to being open during the day and at night.
Right.
And then we closed during the day and just stayed open at night. We went from having an a la carte menu to having an a la carte menu and a tasting menu. Then we went from having those to just a tasting menu.
So you're back to where you started.
Back to where I started. And that was a hell of a learning experience. Running your own place is you always think you could do it. You're always like, I can do this.
You're like, what? I already cook.
Yeah,
whatever.
I can run my own place. Yeah, I'm good. I'm creative. I can put things on the menu. It's like, okay,
that is,
just start looking at the books, you know, start looking at the numbers. And
yeah.
It gets a little tricky. We made it happen. We did well. People loved it. Wasn't as busy as we'd like it to be. It was in East Lakeview, gluten-free restaurant on a storefront where there's no parking.
Just keep adding up the things against you. So it eventually...
We opened and closed it. Yeah.
Okay.
Kara and I.
So we saw post to post. Wait, so she was there too?
She walked out of the bank and walked into to Senza the first day we were open because the general manager came in drunk too many times and he just had a problem. So we.
So she left her bank job to come work in her kitchen with you or work in the restaurant.
She ran the front of the house.
Any experience?
She literally walked out. No, zero experience. Literally walked out of the bank like at lunch and came and worked the first service.
So then you went from sort of not seeing each other to seeing a whole lot of each other.
Yes, and it's been that way ever since, yeah.
So Sensor closes, and then how does Oriole start to take shape?
A couple regulars, well, three key regulars all had the same kind of plan. They were like, we're going to get this guy, if he wants to open a restaurant, we're going to make it happen. And they all three provided a very good, I should say four, or maybe even five people. I shouldn't say three because there's a group of a couple of us.
Sure.
One guy said, hey, if you ever want to open a restaurant, let's talk. I can probably get the money. One guy said, hey, if you ever want to open a restaurant, I've got a tiny little spot behind, I'm essentially the landlord of this building. He has this little spot behind his bar. And the other guy was like, if you guys need any sort of financial support or any support, I got it. So those three things happened all at once. And
the restaurant closed.
And the restaurant closed. And they were all super respectful. And none of them tried to do this any earlier. You know,
right.
It was like they waited it out, you know.
That's really respectful that they didn't try and poach you.
No. These dudes are all stand-up guys, and they would never do that.
So you have the space, you have the money, you have your wife running the front of the house.
Mm-hmm.
When did you... And you have another partner as well, right? Pastry chef?
Yeah, Jeannie. Yeah.
Jeannie. Was she the pastry chef that was yelling at you back in the day?
No.
That was just a different pastry chef.
That would be... Jeannie yelling at somebody would be terrifying. she, like, could be, like, in a metal band for sure.
So you have your two partners. You have the backing of the space. How does it all come together? How do the final pieces fall into place?
It was kind of just... making sure that we had the right people on the build out, right people on creating everything, and everybody's super motivated to do that. You know, everybody wants to have their input. You know, and I'm very lucky with that.
So opening up, I would say another fine dining tasty menu restaurant in Chicago, in a city that is rife with small fine dining tasting menu restaurants. Could have gone the other way, but you have seen success pretty much from the start of when it opened, which was not that long ago.
Yeah.
What do you owe to that, and how did you make a menu that was going to stand out and be unique?
It went through our minds a lot that we were just definitely taking a huge risk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in the beginning, we were willing to be flexible with how we kind of approached
approach the restaurant. Do exactly what we want to do first, and if we need to kind of sway one way or the other, we will.
Which is important to have that flexibility.
Yeah. It's not necessarily smart to do that, but it's better than nothing. Better than all or nothing.
Did you find that sort of from your confidence of cooking for so many years? Like, you didn't have to prove that, like, I said I'm going to do this and I'm going to do this?
Well, I think I'm just stupid. You know what I mean? I think I'm just, like, I'm just dumb. I think I can do it, so I did it. And luckily it worked. I owe it all to Kara and Jeannie and Tim and Aaron. You know, I can't do this by yourself. And I owe all of it to them. And that's why I knew. Because we had this amazing team right from the beginning. People that knew how I operate. You know, it's like, it's not going to fail. Like, we're not going to let it fail. It's not going to happen. It's not an option.
And so how would you, for people who may have not had the chance to come to Chicago or been here yet, how would you describe the food and your approach to it?
It's hard for me to nail that one down. I lean towards a lot of Asian ingredients, a lot of Asian flavors, not necessarily delicate ones, more bold. I kind of want everything to taste. This is something I learned from Mike Simmons, actually, is that I want everything to taste as much like itself as it can. You know, whether I take sugar or salt or acid or whatever it is, I want that element of that dish to taste as much like it can, and then put those things together. The course is kind of cleanse. I don't know. I can get really deep into it.
But get deep.
I try to use actual courses as palate cleansers. You know, 3 or 4 times throughout the meal. I try to wipe your palate with something that also tastes delicious, not just here's a little scoop of something acidic.
sorbet. Yeah.
You know, I try to make sure that you're always, there's always contrast, you know, and I think it works out pretty well.
Well, I mean, it's worked out very well. I mean, we could go through the list of accolades, but I don't think I need to embarrass you with, I mean, what is like a laundry list from like Michelin, Food and Wine, you know, James Beard nods and things like that. Yeah. I guess when you get so many accolades and recognition so early, how do you keep focused on pushing and growing and being at the restaurant? Because it's so easy to be like, okay, I'm here, now I'm going to go on like the never-ending chef circuit around the world for events and things like that.
That's the hard part.
Yeah. How do you stay focused and at the same time knowing that's part of it? And you've earned the right. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it because you've also earned the right to go around the world and have insane opportunities from legendary chefs.
Yes.
So how do you balance it?
I pick and choose which ones I feel like are I shouldn't say worth it, but I pick and choose ones that are worth it.
Yeah, say it.
You know,
not all of it's worth it.
Yeah, not all
of it. Not every party is a good party.
Yeah, exactly. There's a life experience and a focus balance that people have to have. I wish that I was here every day, all day, which for the most part I am. I think probably 95% of the time, probably higher than that, 99% of the time I'm at the restaurant working service from beginning to end. But there is that 1% of time where I'm like, I have to go and cook with Ducasse for a week. Like, I have to.
I mean, twist my arm.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Bend my knives.
But the thing is that I've got Tim and I've got Jeannie that, I mean, they're here and they know exactly what I want. You know, and it doesn't suffer. And you have to find inspiration from a lot of different places. And what's better than, you know, going to France for a little while, or going to New Orleans to cook for a little while, or going back home to cook for a little while? That everything kind of inspires you. And if you stay in the same place, you know, you can read books or watch TV or look at Instagram or something. But I'm just not into, you know, just looking at other people's stuff and doing it.
No. So finally, what would you like to see the future of the restaurant and for people to experience as they come in and as the word spreads?
I think what we wanted in the beginning is definitely what we have now. We want a warm, comfortable environment, no pretense. We want people to feel very comfortable, and we want people to come back, and we want people to not spend too much money. It's expensive, but it's not, I don't think it's too much money, you know. I think the value is pretty good on this one.
Yeah.
Internally, I just want everybody to make money and to be happy and to be creative and have a good lifestyle and be able to come to work, be happy about what they do, and be able to go out on the weekends and do whatever they want to do in their life and
just see their wives and husbands,
exactly,
and partners.
Yeah, yeah, yes. Exactly. Good thing Tim and Jeannie are a couple, so that would be tough.
Oh man, this is like couples day every day.
That's how I met Jeannie. They're yeah.
They've been together for a while.
All right. Well, Chef, congratulations. If people want to find you guys online, where can they find you?
OrielsChicago.com.
And if they want to find you in real life, what's the best way to find the restaurant? Because it's tucked away down an alley behind a freight elevator.
Look for the awning.
There's a sign outside.
There's a little sign.
It's not completely, like, you. It's just far enough down the block where you start to go like, what the? Okay, there's the sign.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to eating tonight.
Oh, yeah, that's going to be great.
I'm very excited. We have another band from the archives on Snacky Tunes, and then we have a live performance here on heritageradionetwork.org.
You should understand there's nothing to talk about. You and I may just disagree, you and I can't relate.
Do you mean?
What do you mean? You could hardly get to your feet. You won't leave yourself alone. How could you turn this down? Something you needed. You left off on the telephone that you had been meaning to dial. Deny, terrible you. You hurt yourself to the bone. You say that this doesn't matter to you. Little Lucy, oh, why won't you leave yourself
Following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com. The following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit rt11.com.
Hi, it's Jameson Fink, Senior Digital Editor for Wine Enthusiast, and welcome to the most wonderful time of the wine year. It's sparkling wine time. It's the holiday season. Get ready. Buckle up. You've got your holiday parties, your fancy meals, your get-togethers, and then, of course, all culminating in what is the Super Bowl of sparkling wine, New Year's Eve. So I just want to give you some advice on how to get the most bang for your buck when you're shopping for sparkling wine. Now, I'm not going to say get wine X, Y, or Z. I'm going to instead give you a type of sparkling wine from France to look for that is going to give you a lot of deliciousness, a lot of flavor, and a lot of quality, and that is Cremant. So just look for any wines that say Cremant on the label. And it'll also say, after that, it'll say Cremant from a place. Like it'll say Cremant d'Alsace, or Loire, or Bordeaux, or Burgundy. Burgundy will say Bourgogne. But any of those, they should be, I don't know, I'm going to say if you get it on sale, $15. I'll head to my bets and say $20, just so I don't get in trouble. Say for around $20, definitely not more than $30. I don't think I've seen one $30 or more. If it is, it better blow my mind. But it's much cheaper than champagne, and it's made in the same high-quality method. It's the secondary fermentation is in the bottle. This is good stuff, folks. So that is my tip for as far as, you know, like what to buy. But also want to back up, even though I kind of hyped it up in the beginning about December being such an amazing time of year for sparkling wine. Well, really, let's just jump to January and your New Year's wine resolution. Your first one should be drink more sparkling wine, drink it all the time. I love still wines, love my still whites, love my still reds, no offense, but sparkling wine is really something that it's not just for celebrations, even though I just said it is. Well, I didn't say it was just for celebrations. I just was, you know, saying holidays, et cetera. But really, January, February, March, April, May, rest of the calendar year, you should always be drinking sparkling wine. Just for food that's really popular and that's beloved, like fried food, it's definitely the best wine for fried food. Fried chicken, French fries, potato chips, anything that's beige and crispy is a sparkling wine slam dunk. And but it's not just for the salty snacks and the fried things. Seafood, salads, and not just for like lighter things, like, oh, just having a salad, you know, like just a light lunch, feeling good. It's one of those Shakes the Clown reference. But actually, one of the best food and wine pairings I ever had was steak and champagne. It was a rich vintage champagne, and I was like, champagne and steak, you can't do that. And it was sensational and phenomenal. And I think one of the reasons why is with something like a steak, you know, it's that kind of cab in a slab mentality. You got a big piece of meat, you need a big wine to stand up to it. But there's also that contrasting thing where you kind of want to, you know, refresh the palate to have something. You have something rich and heavy, you counteract that with something light and refreshing. So, you know, go ahead and open up a bottle of champagne or sparkling wine when you have a steak or anything, any a burger. Or anything where you've got a lot of competing things on it. Like, you know, you put a burger, you got your ketchup, your mustard, your pickles, some cheese, I don't know, maybe some hot sauce, condiments, various condiments and pickled and preserved things. You know, sparkling wine is great with that. So, and brunch, fantastic. I mean, nothing beats a sparkling wine brunch, long lunch with sparkling wine. That's pretty much my idea of heaven. So that, I guess, is my New Year's wine resolution to you. I guess another resolution would be drink wine in alternative packaging, like a box. I just wrote something for, I got asked by Forbes, sort of like, what would I bring as a Secret Santa? And I said a 3-liter box of wine, this high quality, Sicilian wine. It's made from organic grapes. It's 4 bottles, you know, in 1 3-liter box for about, I don't know, it's like $30, $32. It's easy to wrap. It's got a handle on it. You can carry it everywhere. I mean, what's not to love? So, I guess my two resolutions would be more sparkling wine and don't turn your nose up at things like box wine or Tetra Paks or even cans and things like that. So happy holidays, everyone. And I'll be raising my champagne flute to all of you at Snacky Tunes and all of you listening in. And oh, that reminds me, one more thing. I just wrote a diatribe defending the champagne flute, which a lot of sommeliers and wine pros and champagne folks hate on. So if you just Google champagneflutewinemag.com, you can read that and tell me if you're on Team Flute, hashtag Team Flute. And thanks again. Take care. Cheers.
Welcome back. We have Thick live in studio. Woo, Nikki, Sherry, hi. Kate, welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Hi.
Grimstreaker and Annie Hart both said that we should have you on, so
here we are. Oh, that's so sweet of them.
Like, totally, they totally separately.
Oh, they just
have them come on. Yeah. One of the interviews I read with you, you talked about how female bands are taking over the male dominated scene.
Sure, but was that me? Perhaps. That sounds like something I would say.
How? What do you think the gap is that female bands are covering that male bands are not able to do anymore? Or just why do you think of there is the rise is happening?
I could give an opinion from my perspective. I've been playing music here since I'm 17, like in New York City. And I was used to going on Craigslist and there were so many dude bands that were like, we don't want girls in the band. Like, we're just looking for guys. And I was always the only girl in an all-male band, and we would play so many shows, and it was, like, so dominated by dudes all the time. And I think we saw, like starting a couple of years ago, like, all these girl bands were, like, popping up, which is, I think, amazing. I think, like, it was a camaraderie of, like, everyone, like, communicating about what they were doing.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that became the thing. It was, like, now people are, like, dude bands, like, it's all about the girl bands.
So wait, can you ask the question again?
Yeah, what do you think the female bands bring to the table that the male bands were no longer bringing to the table?
You go first then.
Something that I know is a safe space. Like, it's just, I don't know, more of an inclusion. Sometimes when I first moved to New York, I'd go to shows, and I'd, like, love going to any kind of show, and it was always, like, really aggressive. Which is fine, but almost too aggressive. Like, where up front, you just get smashed and pushed in the face. Just like, and it's fun, but it almost felt, like, violent. And it wasn't like, let's just party together. Let's, like, jump around together. It's like, I'm going to beat you up. And I felt like all the shows I used to go to just got more and more aggressive. And so I think that's something that I know Thick does. I can't talk for every single female fronted band or female bands in general. But I think we bring more of a safe space of, like, respect everyone, respect their space, respect safety, like, have fun and be together and together. That's how I just feel about it.
Yeah. Where it used to kind of be a girls to the front was something you would have to say, and now I feel like at our shows, at least, like, we don't ever have to say that.
And anybody's up front, but now it's like, boy, girl, anything you want to be, like, you're up front and you're included, and you're just not, you're respected.
If you get crowd surfed, I feel like you always land, like, people, like, help you land, and, like, look out for you. And I think that women sometimes in this scene have a chip on their shoulder that men don't have. It's always been assumed that some guy can pick up a guitar and play music mm-hmm. that sounds kind of like what everyone's already played and get decent shows and be booked. But I feel like there's, at least for me and some other women I talk to, there's a sense of having to prove yourself a little bit more before you're taken seriously, which I think just changes a lot of what we say and what we do as a band.
Right. It's like, they're a girl band and they can play.
Yeah. Always. Like, come always. On.
Yeah. But do you feel that that is changing at all, or even, like, slightly a little bit better?
Yeah, definitely. Yes.
We can say slightly. Marginally better.
Oh, I think definitely yeah. better. I mean, the New York Times wrote an entire article about it, that yeah. women are ruling rock music. So I think people are taking note. And that was kind of sweet, because a lot of actually guys in our scene, came up to me and they were like, oh yeah, we were happy to see you in it, but I mean, duh, we all know that you guys, like, women are kicking ass in rock music. And I was like, well, you might think that, but I think as a broader general acceptance, there's still a lot of work to be done. I think in Brooklyn it's changed a lot in the past mm-hmm. couple of years.
I mean, that article came out about 2 months ago, and you said people have seen you in it, but have you seen even more response for it, or what has kind of been the result of being in that article, or people's perception?
More people listen to our stuff on Spotify. Yeah. It seems like all different types of people, like, have reached out on, like, Instagram. Like, I guess more people, like, following it on Spotify and, like, Instagram. And it's not, like, one specific, like, type of person. I feel like it's all different types of people, which is really cool. So, like, that's always really good to see.
Do you feel that, I mean, you're still relatively young, but do you feel that there's, you know, like, 15 or 14 or 16 year old girls reaching out to get influence?
I want more. I have a little sister, she's 16, and I'm like, tell your friends that I'm your cool older sister and hang out, you know, listen to Thick. And she doesn't really, but I love
she's
that
playing guitar though.
I wish when I was 16 I had women playing like this, you know. I really Alanis mm-hmm. Morissette was my thing when I grew up. I loved Alanis.
That's
but
so
I wish
true.
And like I don't know, I just wish I would love younger women to be like, oh man, like, this is so cool, just be inspired. by it.
But. I'll never forget the 9-year-old girl at our Richmond show who came up after the set and talked to each one of us and was like, you know, I think you played really well. And she was just so cute and so small. And I was like, thanks. It's very sweet of you. Do you play music? She was like, I like to sing and dance. And I'm like, you should keep doing that. Like, definitely keep doing that because it's really fun. She's adorable.
Can we hear a song?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So this one's Bleeding. It's about getting your period as you do. And like all the chaos that comes with it. Like, you hate yourself. You hate your friends. You hate New York City. It usually happens every month.
Why does New York City get hated?
Oh, my God.
It brings it out.
I was on my bike, and I was like, I fucking hate it. I hate everybody right now. And I hate the cars. I hate the people. It's too fast. And then, like, 4 days later, I'm like, I love this place. It's just part just of
too
having
much
here.
Stress.
Yeah. But it's, like, it's the beauty of having the Bleeding. I love it. So that's this next song is called Bleeding.
Great. Here we go, live on Snacky Tunes.
My boss is such a dick and I just told them off. I think my friends all hate me. Maybe I should just get lost. Don't touch me.
You talk about your influences being Blink-182, Taking Back Sunday, and I'm curious how their lyrics kind of square with what you're writing about. It's just because sometimes there are like very like party boy or like girlfriend type stuff. What do you pull from them, and what do you leave behind?
Well, they are just so much fun, and they don't take themselves too seriously. And when we started Thick a couple years ago, Sherry and I, it was all about fun. And it was like a party band. It really was.
Yeah,
I'm like, I don't see enough women partying on stage and like banging their hair and all that kind of stuff and like not taking themselves too seriously and writing like stupid songs. And like one of our first songs was Take Your Clothes Off and Party With Me. You know? Because
yeah.
That was something that we would do.
Yeah, I feel like the hardest thing sometimes like being in bands is to have fun. And I feel like when I like joined Thick and I was talking to them, I was like, oh, like this is so fun. I mean, we figured out how to like have fun and not be like
well it's a balance drunk, you can have fun and still band, play well at
right.
first yeah. we would have fun and like we were fun to watch but we were not very good to listen to and to be honest we were terrible but it was always always fun and it's still just as fun but now I'm like wait I've been playing guitar for so long like let's like take ourselves
make
a little
effort.
Bit seriously
right.
and make an effort like so we can perform
yeah
well.
We like I think we're fun. We found the balance
so that's why I love like, I thought they were just so funny and they didn't take themselves seriously and Take It Back Sunday, I don't even know.
Also, those melodies, I think, they've always been really easy to remember. Because I listen to all that stuff, like, I grew up on Long Island, like, middle school, high school. And, like, I don't know, they're super easy and fun. And
catchy hooks, lots of harmonies, I feel like. for sure.
That definitely wears off on us.
And for writing your lyrics and kind of not just being pigeonholed as like a girl band or just writing things like that, how do you balance it? Because they're super simple, but they're also really meaningful and have a lot of depth. So like, how did you balance to get your message apart while being fun, taking yourself seriously, not being put into a corner?
I think there's real things that we write about. I know all the songs that we have so far, like, I actually feel it when I write it, you know, or we write it together. Yeah. And it's, like, real.
They're extremely honest.
They're honest, yeah.
And in that way, I think it makes them relatable and easy for people to understand, because it's a lot of the stuff that people go through is mutual. It's shareable with other audiences, and regardless of, like, your perspective or background.
And something I've been trying, like, I've struggled with throughout Thick is, we do write a lot of songs about love and heartbreak or just kind of fucking stuff up in relationships. And it's like, I'm like, oh, I shouldn't be writing about love, because that's all women do is write about love. Like, that's too girly. But I'm like, wait, why are we putting down females? And what we it's okay to be a girl and talk about love. You have all men writing about songs and love and heartbreak. Why can't girls sing about it? And why are we pigeonholed as being a
girl who talks about only?
And so I had to struggle with that for a while. And I was like, you know, fuck it. This is like real. I'm going through a heart. I'm going through a breakup right now, and I want to sing about it. Or I made a fool of myself last night talking to somebody, like some girl or boy. Like, I, you know. So it's just kind of, yeah. It's very honest, as Kate said.
Yeah, it's all the experiences also that people go through. So it's like listening back to her music, it's really interesting knowing like what everyone in the band was going through with like a certain person, like relationship. And I think like that's really cool.
It is.
If they're so honest and like of a piece in time, have you now written enough songs that had enough distance that you'll sing something and be like, I'm so embarrassed.
Yes!
But I went through that. And then there's some distance.
Oh, I hate it. Wasting My Time is my least favorite song to play. I hate.
Why is that?
Because it's about, well, it's about, I was like, it's about a breakup, a really hard one, and it's just so whiny, and it's like, ugh, like, I don't even, it is angry, it's like, I don't know, I never loved you anyway, which is true, which I like that part, but I was like, you're leaving, it's like, shut up, Nicole, get over it. It was, that's the only song I'm like, ugh.
Everyone else likes that song, though.
Yeah. I mean, you gotta play it for the fans.
It's like a grunge song, I feel like.
Our one fan, Sherry's mom.
Yeah. She's like, I really like that song, even though I can see that it's painful.
She like relates. She relates to all the lyrics.
And do you ever find that if you come to a song that's not as honest, you say that the other band members will be like, you need to go back and redo this or kind of come a little bit more correct?
Yeah, I'm like, you need to face the wall and rewrite.
Well, we'll be playing together and like it just won't go anywhere. When we have a song, when we write songs, it just comes so easy.
Yeah, it locks, really it nice locks really in. It locks in. Or it doesn't. And if it's not locking in, I think we just like move forward.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, you know what? I'm not really into this. Like, it just doesn't really go anywhere. We have quite a few of those where, like, it just didn't really
go anywhere.
Hit the hearts.
Was it because the content wasn't true, or just, like, it just didn't come together for all the other elements?
Well, we have a couple, like, actually well structured songs, but I don't. One song we have, it's done. I don't like the melody of it. You know, I like the context. I like the words. I like the lyrics, but I don't like the way I sing the verses, and I haven't found a way to fix that yet.
Yeah, and we've gone back and revised some older ones too, where we're like, this is great from this point on in the song, but let's just rip this apart and like give it a whole new beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, as you get older and you can like look back in the past, you like admit things to yourself that you couldn't at the time, so do you have to like change a few words or a couple of lyrics based on like, you're like, actually I was lying to myself then, but now I know it is.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, what's I'm blanking right now, but there's some songs I sing about like men, and now we sing about women. So it's just like that. We've changed that quite a few times. Which,
that is pretty funny.
Yeah.
Also, making certain lyrics more gender neutral overall.
Yeah like in Bleeding.
Yeah, it's trying more gender neutral, because when we wrote it, I was like a freaking like so unoblivious to the. I was like so oblivious to the world and like the culture and society, all this kind of crazy stuff. I was just like insensitive at times, you know, unintentionally insensitive. So I think we're just more aware of what we're right now.
When did you start making it gender neutral, or like was it a conscious decision, or how did that evolve?
When two of us became gay. No. Now when we both started dating women, I think we've opened. I've never been part of the LGBTQ world before, so now, honestly, that was a huge thing for me. I'm like, wait, I don't want to keep saying about boys because I'm in love with a woman, and I think you can talk about
both of those things.
Or whoever you're in love. So that woke me up.
Yeah, it makes you more aware to, like, these lyrics could be for anyone, so you could, like, replace, like, boyfriend with girlfriend, or, like...
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think just... We have so many friends that are, like, really respectful and aware of things. I think, like, being around those people, like, it makes us aware of, like, we should totally change that.
Yeah.
We want to honor, like, everyone's feelings and, like, make them feel safe, not just
relate to this song. It's not just about, like, some girl and a boy. It's like, and women, we say women now, I try to say women, yeah. But like, it's just being more thoughtful.
Is it harder to fit in the two syllables versus girl?
I love saying the word girl though. I just love how it feels. Like, mm-hmm. I just like girl.
Because saying one. Boyfriend is like, I think like since the 70s, it's just been so like how it's said, like in music, boyfriend. Like, it's fun to say something different.
Can we hear another song?
For yeah. sure.
What are you going to play for us?
The next one is called Girly.
Oh, yeah.
yeah. About that. We're just putting out a music video for the song, too.
Cool. Here we go, live on Snacky Tunes. So you just got done or doing your first session for your new EP last weekend?
Yeah.
2 weekends ago? Mm-hmm. Where are you recording? What's the process?
We are recording at Cowboy Recording Rig, I think is what it's called. It's in Greenpoint with our friend Mario. He did Girly as a single for us and just like nailed it really fast. It was such an easy process. So we decided to go back and work with him for this next EP.
And how has it evolved from the earlier work? Or is there any changes besides pronouns and thinking about girls instead of guys?
Oh, are you talking about like
the musical
the recording part or the song?
The songs.
I think they're growing up as we're growing up.
Yeah.
I think musically and content-wise, it's shifted a little.
A little bit better. I can never play any. I still kind of fuck up on the ribs, but like now I can actually like nail them.
Yeah.
So that then. Sherry's a little more simple on the drums. She was a constant fill. The whole the first year of Thick was as a fill.
Yeah. I think we were taking more notice into parts and dynamics and really like breaking it down section by section if we want it to shift in a certain way or really have a buildup that's effective and trying to work on that as a band and making sure that all three parts fit together mm-hmm. for every piece of the song in a way that we haven't necessarily dissected things as much in the past. It's a slightly more thoughtful process.
I think it's also really... It's, like, way easier now. I think being in a studio, I feel like we're, like, way tighter.
Yeah.
It's more like, fluid.
It fewer just, takes.
Yeah.
Do everything live.
We know what we're, like...
We screw want, a click track.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just, like, run with it.
And you also have some upcoming shows as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. We are playing on November 6th at Elsewhere, which just is opening up.
Finally. Shout out to Rami and Jake.
Yeah, I love those guys.
They're old friends of Snacky Tunes and patiently waiting.
Oh, they're so fantastic. Yeah. I'm really excited for that space. I think it's going to be a really, really good addition to Brooklyn and Bushwick particularly.
Or even better, like bringing back something that's been missing for like a couple years.
Yes.
Yeah.
R.I.P. Glasslands.
R.I.P. Glasslands.
That was so nice. I was just reminiscing about one of those shows the other day. And then we're also playing at Union Pool on the 9th. And then we're taking a break and playing a New Year's Eve show at Rough Trade with Diarrhea Planet.
Amazing.
That we're so stoked for, because we're all giant fans of Diarrhea Planet. We were like, that's all we want to do is play with Diarrhea Planet.
I think we're going to retire after that show.
Yeah, we'll be done. Click is done.
So we're like... So we were like at practice like a year or two ago, and Nicole's like, all I want to do is just open up for Diarrhea Planet, and that's it. We're going to retire. So I guess we're retiring the next day.
Yeah, so we're done. We're done.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hopefully the EP gets finished before then.
We've got
the last session.
Oh, we've got a month and a half, 2 months.
Yeah.
2 months.
Oh, okay. We're good. Who gets to play for when the ball drops?
Probably not us.
I don't know if the show will even go that late. Yeah. I have no idea.
Oh.
I assume Diary Planet.
I would assume that anything that's happening that night, like
it
you're,
should.
Like you're there, you're not gonna. Like,
so. Right. I hope they play. Kick us out at like 11:30.
Yeah, yeah. You're like by 11:30. Like okay.
11:59.
This did not work
I'm
out.
I'm stuck in bed for now.
I hope they play Ghost with a Boner on midnight.
Oh yeah.
On New Year's Eve.
Can you make the request?
Yeah.
You can probably just be like, hey. We'll make sure we have time for one more song. But where can people find you? Listen to Spotify, etc. Instagram,
Spotify, Bandcamp, Instagram, Facebook. We are pretty findable, I think.
Thick.band.
Thick.band is our website.
It's actually true,
because you can actually make websites that are .band now. And we, what else? I think Instagram's the most fun.
Thick in Brooklyn. Facebook, Instagram.
Brooklyn spelled out.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks for coming by. What are you gonna take us out with?
Luke's Diner. Puke's Diner. It's just that's what we're doing. Puke's Diner.
Yeah, it has two names.
Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week with another live episode of Snacky Tunes. Here we go. We'll be right back.
talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.